Hold on, I'm just setting a timer real quick. Forgive me. But I'm Peter Vogel. I'm an alcoholic. I like to include my last name because thankfully I don't have to be anonymous with you guys. My sobriety date is February 14th, 2018. Joe has 9 days more than me. So, yeah, I know. Oh, we have the same home group. I'm actually down here for my bachelor party. And, yeah. Marlon's hosting me. Marlon's my best friend and my best man. I'm going to just tell you a little bit like what it was prior to drinking, how it was drinking, and then what it was like when I was sober. I think there was a lot of events that took place in my past that I don't think made me an alcoholic, but if I don't go and do the steps and work through it, I will definitely drink about it today. So to just give you a brief overview, I grew up in a house with a mother that was addicted to drugs. Oh, that was not what I wanted to do. And thank you very much, everyone. what am I doing? There you go. I got it. I grew up with a mother that was addicted to drugs. Her occupation was a coke dealer. You know, that's what she did to support us. My father left when I was about 6 months old. The cops took him out of the house, and I didn't really see him too often. It was probably around the age of six. I had a stepfather that came into my life, and I was overjoyed at the fact that there was like a man in the house now. And he kind of turned into my biggest nightmare. He mentally, physically, and sexually abused me. And I kind of just withdrew from everyone. I remember like the specific moment where like through the progression of my life, now I get to look back and say, because it's a constant journey of evolving this higher power that I have, you know? And so I look back on my life and I look at the higher powers that I had. And I think from day one, it was my mother. You know, she wasn't really available emotionally, but she was the one that clothed me, you know, fed me, protected me. You know, she was the biggest thing in my life. If I was ever scared, I would go to her. And this day with my stepfather, he chased me into the bathroom. And I grabbed the cordless phone before I went in there. And I start frantically calling my higher power. I'm calling my mom. And as the phone starts ringing, it cuts out. And I just hear a slow knock on the door. And he says, "You got to come out sometime." And I was like six or seven. And I didn't realize that the cordless phones didn't work if you unplugged them. I thought they just worked. You know, I didn't really put too much thought in it. And from that moment, I kind of lost faith in my mom, and I turned to my next higher power, which was anger. And I rode that out for the next like 5 or 6 years until I found alcohol. And then that gave me that sense of relief that I was looking for. You know, like the anger made me feel more powerful. I wasn't vulnerable. I was less afraid, even though I was running on fear. You know, but I felt like I can do things I normally wouldn't do if I got angry, you know. And then I found alcohol, and it did all of that. Now I can kind of let my guard down. I can be that happy person like I always wanted to be. You know, like deep down, I just wanted to be a happy person that could be loved, you know, but I was just so angry at everyone. And alcohol kind of lifted that for me. And that turned into my next higher power for the next 17 years of my life. You know, it's probably the age around 13, 14, I'm drinking and smoking every day. That's when I dropped out of school. I left school after eighth grade, and I moved out of my mom's house, and I was just kind of running the streets for a bit. I moved in with my sister that's 10 years older than me, and I overstayed my welcome there after about a year. You know, we were drinking and smoking together, and one day I'm drunk, and I kick in her door, because I think that's what a man does, is show how angry and powerful and strong they are. You know, because that's what I witnessed growing up. Like that, it was just ingrained in me that when you're upset, you show how strong you are, you know? I kick in the door. She tells me I can't stay there anymore. Now I'm back just kind of couch surfing. I'm around the age of 15 or 16 at this time, you know? And my alcoholism is constantly progressing, you know? And I didn't really see a problem with it at all because, like, I felt okay. Like, I felt like I was an adult now. I'm a man. This is what men do. It's just like this is constant thing, like I'm trying to become this like man that I think I need to be, and I can never figure it out. You know, so I was just constantly trying to fill this hole that I could never fill. It was around 16 or 17. I'm eating dinner over at my friend's house, and his dad goes and says to me, he's like, Peter, do you have anywhere to go? You're here every day. And my friend looks at me like, dude, say something. So I go, no, I don't. And he goes, what do you mean? I was like, I don't have a place to live right now. And they took me in, and it was like kind of the first time in my life I had structure. And like my alcoholism, I feel like kind of slowed down a bit. You know, I wasn't drinking as much. You know, I was actually going on family vacations for the first time, having dinner at a set time. And there was like this schedule and like everything was planned out. And it, I guess it was something that I was like really craving in life, you know, instead of just like running on self-will. But sure enough, I overstayed my welcome there, you know, because alcoholism does not stop. As we learned in the book, froth emotional appeal seldom suffices. And even though those people showed me that they loved me, eventually my alcoholism progressed beyond that love. I was out the door again. Now I was around the age where I can use with my mother. You know, my alcoholism progressed to a point where I was no longer just drinking or smoking. I turned into a full-blown heroin addict by the age of 19. You know, and I don't really shy away from that. They talk about that in the book, you know, using high power sedatives, and that's part of my story. I ended up using with my mom. You know, me and her turned into drug buddies. And like looking back on it, when I first got sober, I blamed everything on her. I was like, if she didn't use with me, I was already using. I used long before I ever used with her, you know. Now I get to look back on it and be grateful for the fact that I got to actually spend some time with my mom. Like those are the days I kind of cherish now. It was a dysfunctional family, but it was a family nonetheless. I mean, and I'll be hard pressed to find out if anybody here comes from a functional family, you know. So, I mean, those are the things, those are like the gifts of sobriety today. After doing the work, I get to look at things from an entirely new perspective, you know. I feel like that's what it means to be rocketed to the fourth dimension. You know, it's like you have that shift in perception. You can start being grateful for things that you may have been resentful to or you know, hated, you know. But fortunately, my alcoholism kept on progressing. I was homeless from 19 to like 22, bouncing around from place to place, sleeping behind my job. You know, I was in the union, and I delivered beer. It was great, you know, and I ended up getting into a bar fight. You know, I was 21 years old, I'm on the clock, and this guy goes and says, hey, do you want a Captain and Coke? And I go, ha-ha, because people joke around about giving us alcohol. And he really gave me a Captain and Coke, and he's like, come back on Friday. And I was like, absolutely, because I just got free alcohol. So I know there's probably more free alcohol. So I go down there, I get hammered, you know, just like I always do. I'm playing pool, I'm being cocky. I get into it, some guys, they beat me up, you know, which definitely wasn't the first or last time I got beat up. That's also a common theme in my life. So I got beat up. They ended up contacting my job, and you're not allowed to get in trouble at accounts. You know, I was in the union. Got in trouble at a bar that I delivered to, and I had to go to anger management, substance abuse counseling, see a therapist, go to AA 3 times a week. I went to the therapist one time, and he said, they're like, the most you're going to have to see this guy is 5 times. He told me I have to go 20, and I was like, I'm not doing it. I called up my job, and I said, I'll take voluntary unemployment, please. Like, can you just lay me off? Give me a voluntary layoff, please. I was like, I'm homeless, I have no food, and I just gave them the sob story, and they're like, okay, fine. Now I'm getting unemployment, and I'm just doing whatever I want again. Like, even though that was like a big consequence, I thought I was going to work there for the rest of my life, and everything was going to be on track. I completely destroyed it and just moved on like nothing happened, you know? I just set bombs off behind me, and I just keep on walking. I don't even look back to see the destruction that's taking place. So now I'm around the age of 23. I'm living in a... You know, it was a crack house. I'm going to call it for what it is. You know, I was living in a crack house. I'm sharing a bed with one of my friends, paying $50 a week to live there, and I could barely afford that. I was bartending. I was serving kids underage, getting in trouble for that. Like, I was not caring about my life or anybody else's life. So I ended up meeting this woman. I was 23. She was 44. And I found out her mother passed away and inherited a house and like $75,000. And I went, there's my ticket. you know, because I'm constantly looking for a way to use other people. So 3 days later, I ended up moving into her house, and I lived there for another 3 years. And, like, the progression completely, I hit bottom for the first time in my life. Started going to rehab, like, every few months I'm going through. I think I went to rehab about 17 times. Every time they're like, go to a meeting when you get out, and I never did. You know, I would never just walk into a meeting because I was terrified, you know. I lived about 4 blocks away from the detox, and my dealer lived 2 blocks from me and 2 blocks from the rehab. So, like, I would never make it there, you know what I mean? This is when he hasn't seen you in a week, he's more likely to say, oh, hey, try this stuff, you know? So, like, instantly I would go, and yeah, same story every single time. I finally reached a point, you know, well, actually, there was a point in my life where I was like, there's no way I can go through a day sober. There's just people don't do that. And I finally reached the point where I said, there's no way I can live another day if I have to use. So I went to rehab for the final time. And I was like, this time I'm going to do it. I was like, absolutely. Like, I'm in it. I'm looking into a halfway house to go into afterwards. I was like, I'm going to jump right into the program. Some kids start shit with me and I punch them in the face. I self-sabotage every single time. You know, I got my dose of methadone and I punched them in the face right afterwards because I got what I needed. I have that power now in me and I can go and do what I have to do. And I got kicked out. It was probably about a day and a half later. I overdosed on purpose and I tried to kill myself. You know, I ended up overdosing in front of a church because after the cops kicked me out, the church is about a block away from my house. Some people found me. They drove me down to the hospital and rolled me into the grass. Some nurses carried me inside. And the doctor was like, yeah, he's not going to make it. And there was a nurse that was about my age. I was 27. And she's like, he was just breathing. And apparently they brought me back. And I came to like the next day. And she's standing over me. And she's like, you know, they were going to go and pronounce you dead. And she's like kind of tearing up and crying. And I just said, I wanted to die, you know, because I wanted her to know how hurt and how much pain I was in, you know. And then they were like, oh, you got to go to the psych ward. So instantly they put me away, you know, and I was there for about 9 days. And, you know, I have like this ability to go and get people to like me and feel bad for me. You know what I mean? I'm constantly manipulating people all the time. I mean, I try not to do it in sobriety, but it happens without me even knowing because it's like ingrained in me. So I'm talking to this nurse and I'm telling her about my life because I'm like, just somebody please listen to me. Like, I've been through so much, you know, like my life has been so hard. Just listen to me, please. And she goes and finds out that I was talking to my roommate that as soon as I leave this lockdown facility, that I'm going to go use. You know, I was like, as soon as I leave here, I'm going right to the liquor store. And he ratted on me. And I was like, yo, you said you were going to drink too. Like, how are you going to rat on me, you know? But I feel like that's one of those God moments in my life. You know, he did what I could not do for myself, you know? And he told the nurse. And I think I neglect to mention that I'm actually from Massachusetts. So in Massachusetts, they have this thing called the Section 35. So I got put into an involuntary detox, right? And so I'm in this locked facility. I've already detoxed. Everybody else around me is... you know, on their detox medicine, you know, we're playing Monopoly, I'm manipulating everybody, you know, like, it was a great time. No. I ended up going to a halfway house for the first time, though, and this is, like, where I really got exposed to AA for the first time, and I had to go. They said, you have to go to 7 meetings a day for the first, I mean, 7 meetings a week for the first 30 days. You have to get a sponsor. You have to start working the steps. You have to do your chores around the house. And I was like, okay, well, I kind of want to stay in Boston. You know, I mean, like, I like it here and I don't have anywhere to go, you know? So I went to the meeting and I saw a girl that I thought was really pretty. And I made that my home group. Like, those, that's where my intentions were, you know? I had no intention on being sober, but I had intentions on talking to a woman, you know? Because I wanted to do something to get outside myself, you know? So I made that meeting my home group. I signed up for CHIPS, that business meeting, because that girl sat next to me and she said, he's going to do CHIPS. And I was like, oh man, she's talking to me, you know? And then I was late to the next meeting and I didn't even do CHIPS. So, yeah, I ended up falling into this crowd of people, Like, because there was like, you know, 50 dudes at this halfway house between the two houses. And I fell into the group of dudes that were like, our problem is heroin, not alcohol. And every single time I would go and say, I'm an alcoholic in a meeting, I would say in the back of my head, you don't really have a problem with that. It's not your problem, man. You have a problem with other substances, man. You can drink once you leave here. Like, that's what I was saying in the back of my head. And I graduated that program, and that's exactly what I did. Me and all those guys, we went out drinking. And my life immediately burned to the ground. And, like, that's where every reservation was smashed for me. You know, and then I finally realized that I'm an alcoholic, and this is why I choose this fellowship. I ended up coming back. That girl hit me up, and she was like, hey, why don't you come to this meeting? I think she heard that I relapsed, but she didn't tell me anything. And I went, yeah, sure. And I went to a meeting with her, and then she said, hey, do you want to speak at a detox? And I went and I spoke there with like 3 days sober. I don't even know what I said. I lied about everything. I hid my relapse from everybody for about 5 months until one of the kids that I drank with came back into the rooms. And they're like, okay, everybody with a year or more, raise your hand to show that this program works. And I raise my hand because that's what I've been doing. And he brings me outside the meeting and goes, you're a liar. You're a liar. And I went, get out of here, man. Like, dude, I'm doing my thing, dude. Like, I have it. He's like, you don't have a year. You're lying to everybody. And I got so mad at him because of my lie. You know, I was that delusional. I was like, you should just leave. You don't belong here. You know? So I went and I called up my sponsor and I said, hey, I really don't have a year sober. He's like, you don't? And I was like, no, I relapsed back in October. And he's like, oh, I know. I was like, you know? He's like, yeah, John told me. That was the guy that called me out. So, like, he already told everybody. I thought if I was honest, the secret wouldn't get out. And then I found out nobody cared. Not a single person. Like, and the people that did care, they cared because I was back there. They didn't care about how much time I had. Like, it's kind of irrelevant, you know? Like, I have some sponsees today, and like I have a guy with like 3 months, and sometimes he is more recovered than me because I'm being a maniac, you know? So it's like, is time really relevant? I don't know. I think Einstein said it wasn't. I don't know. But but I ended up coming clean. I got a sponsor, started doing the work, got involved with WIPA, and that was something that like radically changed my sobriety. You know, I traveled all around the country. That's how I met Marlon, and he became one of my closest friends, you know. I ended up going down to a conference in Virginia. I was, so funny enough, Massachusetts State Conference was taking place the same week as Virginia. And I had a resentment towards Massachusetts, like the WIPOC community. And I was like, well, I'm going to Virginia because I don't want to see anybody in Massachusetts. And so I think I'm living in my will. You know what I mean? Like living through this resentment. And that's where I met my fiance. And we started dating long distance. And then I moved down to live on Marlon's couch for a couple months with this like mid-sober crisis I was having, you know. I never got to go to rehab in Florida, so I wanted to at least work at one. So I came down here, started working at a rehab, and it didn't really turn out great. I was like, this isn't as, you know, luxurious as I thought it was going to be, you know. And but this whole time I'm dating this girl long distance, and I ended up moving up to Pittsburgh about 45 minutes outside of where she lived so I can like kind of date her within proximity of her. And because every single relationship I've ever been in, I just went and I moved right in with them, or they moved right in with me, and it's just like this whole thing. So I was like, I'm gonna just try to live close to her and date her. And you know, this is the first relationship in my life where it hasn't failed, so that's pretty cool, you know. COVID hit, and guys, I left AA. I did some Zoom meetings, you know, but once it wasn't in person, I wasn't really a part of anymore. Like, WIPA ceased to exist, and it wasn't really doing the deal anymore, you know. I ended up, you know, just like I started going to therapy 4 days a week, you know, and I was like, this is completely fine. This is my new AA now. And so get engaged, and you know, I asked another guy to be my best man, you know. This guy that lived in Pittsburgh, you know, he was my sponsor, And the first day of COVID, he relapsed and he overdosed in my front porch. And so we found him out there. His lips are blue. I'm terrified. You know, I tried to bring a guy back before and he didn't make it. So I thought the whole time he was going to die. And he's foaming at the mouth, and I was like, he's going to have COVID, and I'm going to give him CPR, and he's going to live, and I'm going to die. You know, because still, in this moment, I'm still thinking of myself, man. You know, I ended up Narcanning him, and he came back, and, you know, I was really grateful for that. You know, but moving forward, I moved out to, like, near Philadelphia from Pittsburgh, and I asked him to be my best man, because I really loved him. And 2 months later, he died, you know, and Marlon came up for the funeral. And I mean, like, Marlon is my best friend, too. And he was there for me, man. And, now my friend Jimmy, his son is going to be my ring bearer at my wedding. So, like, it's, you know, and there was a moment where I felt like an immense amount of guilt. You know, I was like, maybe I shouldn't have brought him back. Maybe I should have let him die. Like, he had a kid. Now there's going to be another kid in the world, and he's not going to have a father, and I know how that feels, and I'm just thinking about myself, you know? And his brother gave me a hug at his wake and said, hey, thank you so much for saving my brother then, because you gave him 2 more years to live. I'm going to cry. And he was able to leave his son here with us, so we have something for him. It's something of him still here. And just that feeling just instantly washed away from me. It was like, you know, God's mouth to my ears, man. And it's like those moments right there where you're like, all you're thinking about is like everything that you did wrong. And it's just like, dude, just stop. You know, like, you did what you thought was right. And now other people are still benefiting from this moment, you know. But after he passed away, I drove down to my sponsor's house. And my sponsor lives in Virginia. When my sponsor overdosed, I got a new one that was in Virginia. Like, everything was on Zoom. So, like, I couldn't go down to my local meeting and get a guy. So I knew this guy from the program. I really respected him. And I called him up and I said, hey, come we work together. After Jimmy passed away, I drove down to his house and we just did the steps in a weekend, like this workshop weekend together, you know. And it kind of, like, revitalized my AA battery that was completely depleted from COVID. And I jumped back into the rooms. And that's where I met Joe. Me and him have the same home group now, you know. And, it was exactly what I needed. I was able to start sponsoring guys and bringing other people through the steps. It was like all the things that I wasn't doing that I needed to start doing, you know. This fourth step was like, this is something that, like, really changed my perspective, like, coupled with outside help. Like, I didn't realize how, like, the resentments that I was holding on to were really, like moving me forward in life. You know, like, when I first came in, I was terrified to talk to men. Like, I felt more comfortable getting drugs off a random person and putting them into my body and trusting that they were going to do what they needed to do. But meanwhile, like, I wouldn't go and shake another man's hand and ask them for help and to bring me through the steps. And I couldn't trust them, you know. And it's like, then I look back at my fourth step. Oh, your stepfather abused you, your father left you. And now you're going through life as that child still, you know, living in that fear. And it's like, because I'm living in that resentment and that fear that I have of the first relationships that I really developed in life, they dictated the way I was going to go moving forward. So it's like, now I actively put my hand out to men. Anybody that says, oh, they're new, I try to go up to them. I'm not perfect. I don't do it every time. You know, but that's what I try to do today to combat that fear that I have that men are here to hurt me, you know. Same thing with my mother-in-law. You know, I told you guys that I dropped out after eighth grade. I'm currently, I went back and got my GED when I was 28. And I'm in school to be a nurse right now, which is wild. Yeah, I mean, like, some nurses brought me back, man. And, like, I feel like if I can do that for one person, then, like, that's good enough for me. So sorry, I got super bad ADD. I'm going through the FAFSA stuff. I'm doing the college. 15 minutes? I have 23 here. How long am I speaking for? I've been speaking. Oh, okay, cool. So anyway, sorry. But I'm back in school. I'm like the old guy in class. I'm trying to help out the other students. They're like, oh, you're like the dad in class, Peter. You know? I'm like, dude, I'm only 34. They're like, oh, I'm 19. I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess, I am the old guy. Okay. But, so my mother-in-law, she's wonderful. She's in the program. She had 25 years, went out for a year. Now she's got 15. So she has like a lot of years sober, you know, like throughout her life. And she's helping me with my FAFSA and like sitting down and trying to get a study session, like program with me and everything. And I'm like, this woman hates me. Like, why does she not love me? I try to do everything for her and I just cannot accept the fact that, well, I'm only looking at the fact that she doesn't like me because she's like kind of reprimanding me like a mom would, you know, and I'm like, that means she hates me. And I go back and I look at my fourth step. And the first name on my list was my mom. And it says, she never loved me. And then I'm like, now that I'm I have this woman in my life, I'm finally looking at a person like a motherly figure, and then I can't accept the love because I'm seeing my mother. You know, that's me living in the resentment that I had my entire life, you know? So, and it also happens in relationships too. Like if I'm, you know, like my fiance, now that I'm in school, I'm not like as financially secure as I once was. And then so she starts like kind of taking care of me, you know? And then I'm like, she hates me, you know? Because she's like this, she's like this motherly figure in my life. And as soon as that happens, I go and I think that they don't love me because I can't accept the love that my mother ever gave me, you know? So I'm living in that resentment. So it's like, I have to go and constantly try to combat that. You know, I have to work on the relationship that I have with her. On her side, it's perfectly fine. But for me, I got to be accepting that I'm worthy of being loved, you know? And that's something that was really hard for me. I had like no self-confidence whatsoever. I would walk up to you, smile, greet you and be like, oh, I'm Peter and, you know, put on my best face. And then meanwhile, I'll walk away and be like, this person hates me. You know, like they must think so low of me. I got my license when I was 30. I dropped out after 8th grade. Like those are the stuff that are going through my head because of the consequences of my drinking, you know? So, now, though, like, me and my mother-in-law have, like, a wonderful relationship. I call her up, like, every day. We just kind of hang out when my fiancé is at work, and I get home from school, and my mother-in-law will work at our house. Her fiancé lives down the street. She lives there, but he has a special needs son, so sometimes it's a little difficult to work at her house, so she comes and works at our house, and you know, we just hang out. We, like, make lunch together, and it's really wonderful, and it's something that I've, like, wanted my whole life. And by building that relationship with my mother-in-law, it's been easier to build a relationship with my mother. My mother is still actively using, you know, and it was like dangerous for me to be around her for a couple years of my sobriety because I like it was shaky at best in early sobriety. And I would hear in meetings that like, oh, I got sober and I got my family back. And I would say, I hate you. Because when I got sober, I lost my family. My sister's an alcoholic. My mom is a drug addict. And I cannot see them because it is dangerous for me. There's no coming home, you know, from the halfway house on Sunday to go have dinner with her. Like, that wasn't a thing. You know, I would find my mom passed out most nights on top of the stove with the door open because she was always cold. It was dangerous for me to be around her, you know. It took a few years, but at 3 years sober, my sister got sober. And my sister just celebrated 3 years on April 1st. So, like, and me and her's relationship today is just wonderful, man. And AA gave me that. It took some time, but things don't happen in my time. They happen in God's time, you know. And I still pray and I wait for my mom to come around. You know, she'll call me up sometimes and say, hey, I think I have a problem. And I'll go, okay, let's talk about it. I'll give you my experience, and she gives me hers. And then we'll talk on the phone for an hour. And she goes, you know what? I think I feel better. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. And I'm like, you know, she doesn't know that it's two alcoholics coming together to have a meeting. And that's why she feels better. It's the same reason why I feel better when I come to a meeting, because I'm talking to another alcoholic, you know? We're able to relate like no other people can, you know? And I don't know. So that's why I'm really grateful that you guys are all here. You're helping me. Yeah. But it says I talked for 30 minutes on my phone. Okay, so what do I talk about now? But yeah, so it's really wonderful. You know, there is some, I touched upon like the kind of the bad stuff, but there's also been beautiful things that happened in my life. Like I was able to propose to my fiance in Italy 2 years ago, which is something I never thought would happen. Like way beyond my wildest dreams. Like my wildest dreams were maybe one of the apartments above the bar will free up and they only pay $75 a week there. You know, like that was like, those are my goals and aspirations in life, you know. I was able to propose to her and we're setting up the wedding. We're due to get married June 1st. You know, she's literally my best friend. She's my favorite person in the entire world, you know. But I think that's where I'm going to end. I appreciate it, everybody. And with that, I pass.